Good morning. And what a lovely morning it is after that rain. Refreshing. Today, I'm probably going to give a variation on the same talk that I always give. But the title of it is, When Shikantaza Is Not Enough. Emptiness Practice, Compassion Practices, and the Path of Service. So, there's a little variation. So, who can give us the definition of Shikantaza? Does someone want to do that? Do you want me to do that?
Just sitting.
That's right, Shikan, just. And Taza sitting. And our teachers, Tim Burkett, Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, all emphasized Shikan, Shikan, Taza, Shikan, doing the dishes, Shikan, brush your teeth, Shikan, take care of your children, Shikan, everything. So, wholehearted practice. Completely becoming one with whatever we're doing when we do it. Okay, that's the definition. And it means, the sitting part, it means sit down before thinking about yourself. Before thought. So, get up, brush your teeth, put on your clothes, and sit down. Or drive to the Zendo first if you sit here. But just do it before the conscious mind starts churning and saying, well, I can't do it today because of this reason and there's all these other things to do. So that's the meaning of Shikantaza. And I'm just going to go over some of the basics of our practice here. This is a Soto Zen practice center. And Shikantaza is our main practice. And we also emphasize direct experience. Okay, direct experience of emptiness. So Tim says return to zero. And Katagiri Roshi says experience the pivot of nothingness. And when we go there on a regular basis, then we can really create our life in a peaceful way. Katagiri always emphasized, burn the flame of our life force in whatever we do. Burn up our life force. Let yourself be used in the service of life and truth. We emphasize repetition and creating a habit of doing your meditation. We do a lot of things in a repetitious way, and we do a lot of things in a habitual way. But the usual way we do things that way creates problems for us. And but creating a habit of meditation should help free us of that. Hi there. Babies. I enjoy babies. Letting go of the grip of thoughts and relaxing in the emptiness with upright bodily posture. And then returning back to our daily life with bliss-bestowing hands. Hopefully, bliss-bestowing hands. It's a non-conceptual, wholehearted, direct experience versus a cultivation that is step-by-step, or as Tim calls it, step-ladder Zen. So, but of course you'll find out if you practice for a while that there is a stepladder in Zen, actually, that we can climb. But then somebody, if we have a good teacher, they'll pull it out from under us and let us fall now and then. So I want to talk about one of the preoccupations of my first teacher, Katagiri Roshi. He was preoccupied with what we do when our life falls apart. When the bridge falls down and we get a diagnosis of an illness, when they foreclose on our house. I don't know, whatever it is. It's something that we don't expect. It's something that is shocking to us. And he was preoccupied with that. He talked about that a lot, I remember. And this new book that Andrea has edited, Each Moment is the Universe, there's a section in here where he talks about, I think, one of his first experiences of that. Like, what do people do? Even people who are practicing, even people who are great roshis, great teachers at a Heiji monastery, how did they react? There's a story in here about an earthquake that happened when he was there. He was a young, very impressionable monk, and he was watching his teachers. He watched every move they made and how they made their moves. Some of the... And he talks about what happens at this, the event of this earthquake. So the ground starts to rumble, and he's watching how everyone reacts. And he said there's a whole group of roshis that just ran for the cedar trees that were not far from the front entrance at Heiji. And these were people that normally walked very slowly and dignified and were always calm, and they ran. They ran for the cedar trees. I think that made a big impression on him. Then there was another monk who was not well thought of by the other monks, who actually went back and into the zendo during the earthquake to put out the candle so the place wouldn't burn down. That also impressed Katagiri. You've probably heard this story from Tim about the teacher who was in the bathtub having his bath, and his attendant ran in and he said, "Teacher, you know, there's an earthquake." And the teacher said, "Well, I'm having my bath." And his attendant said, "But teacher, it's an earthquake." And he said, "Well, I should look it up." I think he might have asked him just to hand him the towel or scrub his back even. So all these different people had different reactions. There was one really old teacher who couldn't walk very fast, and his attendant was trying to get him to go. There were so many steps to walk down from the front entrance to get out, and he said, He walked as far as the main zendo, and he went up to the mat, like where I'm sitting, and he just said, "I just want to sit here and do zazen." So he often talked about this. Right? He would say, the point of our practice is to become imperturbable. But then he would tell a story about how people would just freak out, you know, when there was a crisis. And I know that you probably all heard many stories about the bridge and about the rescues that happened, and people who did not think. They just ran down to the riverbank and began to pull people out. And if you ask them, they'd probably say, if you ask them, "What were you thinking and how could you be so brave?" Pretty sure most of them would say, I just did what anyone would have done. I just did what the situation called for." So, what will we do? That was always Katagiri's question, and that's my question for you today is, what will we do when life falls apart? And how does this practice help us to live daily life and to deal with those kinds of shocks, from the extraordinary to the ordinary? So, I was going to read you that story, but I don't think I will, but I will read some part of it to you. How do you live in this complicated reality? How do you face the moment when the earthquake suddenly happens? How do you handle yourself in a moment that is beyond your control? When a moment appears, there's only one thing that controls you, the capability that comes from your spiritual practice your ability to face impermanence and deal calmly with the conditions of every moment. So before the earthquake happens, before your mind starts to work and you want to run away, accept every moment as an opportunity presented to you to practice facing reality as it is. And then he says, this was a common thing he would say, life is an emergency case. It's not just the big disasters, but life is. And we talk about life and death in Zen a lot. We talk about impermanence and the fact that things fall apart and we will die. And, you know, it might be nicer to be in another religion, you know, where they don't look so squarely in the face of reality. But we're not in that practice. This is the practice we're in. So he says the moment that we're living right now is where we have to meet that moment, that it's an emergency case because life and death is happening in this moment. Every moment we are born and then we die, you know, that it's arising and falling. And it's just important to seize this moment here and now. But to be generous with yourself. And I think you've all been generous with yourself by coming to hear a Dharma talk. Because you're giving, you're doing what Katagiri says, you're giving yourself to yourself. When you sit down to do zazen, you're giving yourself to yourself. And that's an act of generosity. So now I want to talk about the shift a little bit into, you know, so we talk a lot about emptiness practice, that this is what we need to do, just to sit down and let go of all our preoccupations and directly experience emptiness, directly experience that, return to zero. And that should do it for us, right? We shouldn't need anything else. But I just want to suggest that there are some other practices that can be useful if... sometimes you find that your feelings are really strong due to the result of something, some shock or some news or some loss in your life. And so I'm going to borrow a little bit from the Theravadan and the Tibetan traditions in telling you about some of the things that I've used when dealing with difficult feelings and emotions, and when trying to come to grips with some new reality that might include a loss. So, let's see, practicing patience. And now some of you were at the Shanti Deva class, so now we get to hear again a little bit. I know a lot of people felt like they didn't want that class to end. So Shanti Deva talks about relative bodhicitta and absolute bodhicitta. And absolute bodhicitta is bodhi means the enlightening, and citta means mind. So enlightening mind, or the mind of enlightenment, is what's it's what we're trying to arouse in our practice, is the mind of enlightenment. And according to Shanti Deva and the Dalai Lama and the other Tibetans, teachers, the relative bodhicitta includes our bodhisattva vow to save all beings along with ourselves, not to leave anybody out or anything out, any being out. And it also includes practical suggestions and things that one can do along the way to deal with one's afflictive emotions. Greed, anger, and ignorance arise endlessly. Some of you have heard that and some of you haven't. Those are the three poisons that we're all subject to and that continue to come up for us. Okay? So, practicing patience with the inevitable is considered one of these practices. And being patient with the little aggravations of life is a practice we can do even when we don't have some big issue to work with. You might be happy about. Here's a verse from the Patience chapter. There's nothing that does not grow light through habit and familiarity. Putting up with little cares, I'll train myself to bear with great adversity. And do I not already bear with common irritations? Bites and stings of snakes and flies, experiences of hunger and of thirst, and painful rashes on my skin? Suffering also has its worth. Through sorrow, pride is driven out, and pity felt for those who wander in samsara. Evils avoided, goodness seems delightful. I'm not angry with my bile and other humors, fertile source of pain and suffering, so why should I resent my fellow creatures, victims too of like conditions? That's a little bit about patience from Shantideva, and he's kind of extreme. He's like a real, he gets very theatrical in this book. And I recommend that if you read this book, you do it with a group, because it's a little bit, in some parts, it's a little bit like the fire and brimstone, you know, branch of Christianity. You know, in terms of Buddhism, there are parts that seem a little bit like that. But when my experience, and I've studied this about 4 or 5 times in my lifetime with different people, and then I've tried to read it alone, is that that kind of grandiose, you know, attitude and theatrical attitude kind of gets to me when I'm reading it alone. And then I think, oh, this is weird, you know. But when I study with a group, and especially with someone who's really familiar with this, like Roger Jackson or Judith Regeer, then it seems very different to me. And I can see where the healing is in it, and kind of overlook the real dramatic, heavy-duty, fire and brimstone kind of stuff. So, using suffering and distress as a dharma gate to purify our minds of greed, anger, and ignorance is another practice, and Katagiri has his own take on that. If you don't mind, I'll read that to you. This whole talk is basically just a pitch for the book. So, all right, where is that? I have to find it. I have all my little parts. Thought I had it. Maybe not. Well, what he says, I'll tell you what he says, because I can't find the place. What he says is that we should see the three poisons, we should turn them into the three wheels, and turn the wheel of the Dharma. And the way that we do that is with anger and greed and ignorance, is to see the anger as Buddha. And when you see anger as Buddha, then that anger becomes the Dharma gate. It becomes the teaching. So it's relaxing. It's not easy to do. It's not an easy thing. And I have tried everything I'm going to suggest to you. But to hold one's anger hold it in your sitting practice and relax into it and accept it and show some compassion for it, allows it to move on, allows you to integrate it and allows it to move on, and it prevents just sort of stuffing and overlooking and pushing it down only for it to come up again, because that's part of mindfulness, is to really accept whatever's in our experience. So that's what he says, is that's the way to deal with it, and it's close to what Shantideva is saying. Another way to enter into distress that you might have is to apply mindfulness to it. And in Zen we don't talk about mindfulness a lot. What Katagiri, his phrase was wholehearted engagement, and that seemed to be the closest thing to mindfulness that I heard from him. Wholehearted engagement with whatever it is, whatever's showing up. So if that's fear, if that's anxiety, if that's anger, depression, that to be aware of that, and even to use phrases like Thich Nhat Hanh uses, Breathing in, I'm aware that I feel fear. Breathing out, I'm aware that I feel fear. Sit with that for a while and really explore the textures of that feeling. We don't want to do that usually when we're in the grip of a strong feeling. We want to run away or we want to jump out of our body somehow, distract ourselves. But it's really a great Dharma gate just to sit with those experiences and explore the textures and be very precise about what exactly this feeling is. Because often underneath one feeling is another. So underneath anger is often hurt. Underneath anger sometimes it's fear also, you know, and we find out those things. We get acquainted with ourselves. One practice that Shantideva recommends and other Buddhist teachers is exchanging self with other, exchanging yourself with another. It's a way to develop relative bodhicitta. I want to read some of the verses related to that. That's in the chapter 8 on meditation. So there's two ways. Mostly his verses relate to the relative bodhicitta, the practical ways to work with our minds. Very few verses on meditation itself in the chapter on meditation here. Here's the one verse on that. Verse 4. Penetrative insight joined with calm abiding utterly eradicates afflicted states. Knowing this, first search for calm abiding, found by those who joyfully renounce the world. Joyfully renounce the world. That's what we do when we come here, right? And sit down together. We're joyfully renouncing the world just for a little while. So now, here's the part about the exchange. Strive at first to meditate upon the sameness of yourself and others. Actually, this is the equality of self and other, excuse me. And this is a preliminary to the exchange of self and other. In joy and sorrow, all are equal. That's how we're equal to with each other and how we can feel that we're not separate, that we are totally connected to each other, is to understand that in joy and sorrow, all are equal. Thus be guardian of all, as of yourself. So this is, he's saying, protect all beings, protect everyone as you would yourself. Sounds pretty hard. The hand and other limbs are many and distinct, but all are one. One body to be kept and guarded. We don't talk about, talk about our leg or our hand or our foot. We talk about our body as a whole. So that's what he's using. He's saying, likewise, different beings and their joys and happiness, sorrows are, like me, all one in wanting happiness. So because we all desire happiness, and he's saying we should develop this vow to see everyone as ourselves and to care as much for others' suffering as our own, and that this develops the capacity to respond. I find that inspiring. I don't know. Okay. So other ways to deal with difficulty in our lives and the feelings and the concerns and the worries that come up around experiences of loss or difficulty. We should always look for ways to alleviate our suffering, you know. The teachings aren't saying wallow in your suffering or see everything as suffering and never experience joy, but actually to attend to suffering, attend to discomfort, enter it fully, and then do what you can to alleviate it. Taking refuge in the Sangha, I recommend sharing your concerns with Sangha members, you know, through counsel process or through friendships that you develop. I think over a lifetime, our Sangha friends, our Buddhist friends, are are very precious. They're the people that we can go to for feedback. People who've known us for many years or have seen us through many things are great resources for us, you know, to open up to and to hear their feedback. Getting feedback is really important, I think. And according to Katagiri, emptiness practice leads to repentance. When we sit down, naturally reflection occurs. If we sit down every day, we can immediately reflect on our own behavior and on our experience, you know, and that gives us a chance to repentance is a word many people don't like, but a chance to acknowledge our karma, you know, we can do that just in front of the Buddhas, or we can do that with a friend, and it's very helpful. I rely on my Dharma buddies quite a lot in that way. Intention. Stepping back and assessing whether our motivation is kind and whether we are wishing others well can really help with certain states like anxiety. You know, if you're afraid to do something, if there's something new that you're afraid to do, you reflect on what your intention is, and that your intention is to, maybe if it's not quite to save all beings, but it is to contribute to the good and to not to create harm. That helps. Actually, the Dalai Lama teaches that. If your self-confidence is low, it may be better to reflect on your Buddha nature than on suffering. It's another thing the Dalai Lama says is that traditionally in Buddhism we contemplate dukkha or suffering, you know, as a way, and impermanence as ways to help us wake up and see what we're doing and what we're not doing and put ourselves on the path. But if you know, if you have self-esteem issues or you're lacking confidence, then Dalai Lama says you should reflect on your own Buddha nature and the Buddha nature of everyone. That can be more effective. Another way, when you're in the grip of a strong emotion, you know, say you're really, really angry at someone and you're sure they did something to make you angry, it's a good idea to step back and say to yourself, are you sure? Are you sure about that? You know, just question, especially before taking an action like sending an email to someone or calling them up and reading them the riot act. It's a good idea to just ask that question. Are you sure? And maybe you could also go to a friend and lay the situation out before taking an action and get their feedback. That's a little practical suggestion. And then finally, just remember that feelings and perceptions are impermanent and empty. So go into them, explore them, be mindful. But then always remembering, you know, life is change and I can let go of this. And actually doing that, you know, with the brain, the knowledge of brain development and brain chemistry, doing that is using our prefrontal lobes of our brain. And what happens when we're in an attack of strong feeling is that we're hijacked by our amygdala, which is an older part of our brain. And it's often called the reptilian brain. So when we're in the throes of a strong reaction, that's what's in charge there. And to change that, one way is to involve the prefrontal lobe, to ask these questions of yourself, and it helps to stop the stress reactions that we can sometimes get into. Okay, so those are my suggestions about how to work with developing relative bodhicitta. And now I want to shift a little bit to talk about the path of service a bit, okay? There are a lot of people in this Sangha who are on a path of service through their work or through their volunteer work. And it's a natural thing, I think, when one comes to spiritual life, spiritual practice, after a certain period of time, we feel like giving back. We feel like being generous. And generosity is it's really at the top of the list with the practices. It's like the first practice we should do, apparently, is the practice of giving before we even learn to meditate and sit down. So many of us did it the other way. We began to sit and then developed our generosity. So the thing about service is that whether you're serving the earth through your activities, political activities, or whether you're serving your family or this Sangha or another Sangha, it doesn't matter who you serve. It's just important to find a way to channel the energy of service. And we find particular ways to do it. But sometimes there's something extra that kind of crops up in our minds with regard to service, and something a little bit stinky, as Kata Gary used to say, something a little bit stinky. Something about, I'm such a good person, that's why I'm doing this, or this is my practice, and I put in all these hours. You know, you probably are aware and familiar with that. That's the something stinky about the path of service that it's good to keep an eye on, rein that in. Because actually, service is simply giving and receiving arising together simultaneously. And if we know that, then we can be free of that something extra, you know, that something stinky, and then it can be really vividly alive for us, whatever we do, whatever way we serve. And if you think about serving all of life, then it doesn't really matter, you know, what container you choose to do your service. I always remember that Bob Dylan song where he said, you know, you've got to serve somebody. He woke up to that. That was cool. And I think it's really true. And I think it's really joyful and releasing to serve in some way. I'd like to end here. I would like to hear what you have to say. So I hope I'm not going too over, Paul. Okay. Well, there's an interesting koan about giving. Yunyan's great compassion. So, the case. This is from the Book of Serenity. It's a number of cases that come from the Chinese era of Zen. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, "What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes?" Dao Wu said, "It's like someone reaching back for the pillow at night." Yunyan said, "I understand." Dao Wu said, "How do you understand?" Yunyan said, "All over the body is hands and eyes." Dao Wu said, "You said a lot there, but you only got about 80%. Yunyan said, "Well, what about you, elder brother?" Dao Wu said, "Throughout the body is hands and eyes." And my commentary on that is just that there's something miraculous about throughout the body our hands and eyes. But on the other hand, the koan points to, it's so ordinary, you know, the way we respond with compassion in a given situation is just like reaching back for the pillow. It's just very automatic. And we have that within us now. We can cultivate all kinds of practices, and we can cultivate our minds. We can reflect on things that are ennobling for our minds. But we already have that ability to respond before thought with compassion. It's what a mother does with her child. She just immediately responds. And that seems ordinary to us, right? That seems very ordinary. But there's also something miraculous in that. So I just want to encourage you to explore that, the ordinary and the miraculous. In your life and in the ways that you give and serve life. So that's all I have to say. You should take what you like and leave the rest and tell me what you have to say. Yes. At least.
Well, they gave when he took his vows, they gave him that.
Okay.
And he came to my house, and he had saffron gown on and a deep purple drape, and I was Larry.
Larry.
Is it still Larry? Should I be calling you? But I went to the internet and tried to look up 47 rules, and I just couldn't find it.
You didn't find a link to what sect of Buddhism that Larry's...
Well, it must be some other than Zen.
Right, it's not Zen. The saffron robes are the Theravadan Buddhist wear saffron robes, yes. So, and the countries where the Theravadan Buddhism is still active is Burma, Sri Lanka, where else?
Thailand,
yeah. So he's found himself a container for his desire to wake up. And it's a Theravadan Buddhist container. I see.
Now he smiles all the time.
Well, that's wonderful.
So I need to find out what those 47 rules.
Yeah, I'm sorry I can't help you with that. Right, you can look it up. Yeah, I think so. I think that would help a lot, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Could you ask him, just directly?
Yeah, he's a hard dude to find.
I see. Okay. But it sounds like he's inspiring you.
Oh, my God. He is the kindest, most generous person I have ever known. He's amazing. And he's been around the block 1,000 times. He's been, through hell and back.
So he really... He walks his talk, and he's a good teacher for you, it sounds like. Yeah. Well, good luck finding those 47 precepts. I don't know what sect of Buddhism gives 47. We take 16 bodhisattva precepts here. And we call them precepts, but they're kind of like rules. They're kind of like guidelines for living. Mm-hmm.
For
in Zen, you want to learn about the precepts that we take? Oh, you could look in any of the books downstairs. There's books downstairs you could find that in. You could go Google it, you know, on your computer. It'll probably come up. You'll get a link to it. Pardon me? Oh, right. Well, then why don't you ask someone to show you some books in the library when we're done? Yeah. We used to have them framed on the wall. I wish we still did sometimes. That would be easy to send you to. Right, something to hand out. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Anyone else have something to add or... No. Okay, then. Well, they're not doing it. Sure, you go ahead. Please.
Can you repeat those three...
The three poisons?
The three poisons?
Right, greed, anger, and ignorance.
Ignorance.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.